This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who killed Daisy Zick? That question has been in the minds of police and residents of Battle Creek ever since January 14, 1963. That's when someone murdered Daisy Zick in her home. Hard to believe, but no one has ever been brought to justice for this murder, even though at least three people caught a glimpse of the killer. Writer Blaine Pardo's latest book is called Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick. Blaine Pardo joins us now in the studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, reading about this case, I have to say, Blaine, is like watching a real-life CSI Battle Creek. It really has so many layers.
It's fascinating, too, because, you know, you mentioned CSI. We all are kind of seduced by television and what it tells us about, oh, all the sophisticated techniques for analyzing evidence. But, you know, in 1963, you dealt with true police work, what we would call gumshoe type work, mm-hmm. where they worked their leads, they worked, you know, interviewing techniques, things along those lines, which is really how a lot of cases get solved. I know we all like watching it on television and get pulled yeah. into that, but it's, to me, it's real police work, and that's fun.
They didn't have the advantage of a lot of the scientific breakthroughs, DNA testing and things that we take for granted today.
Oh, true. Even in speaking with a lot of the surviving officers, and it's hard after five decades, mm-hmm. you know, there's not a lot of them left. You know, the training that officers used to get for homicide work in 1963 was around 8 to 16 hours worth of training for it. Now it's weeks worth of training
sure.
on it. So, you know, techniques have improved over time.
Well, tell us, who was Daisy Zick?
You know, Daisy was a really interesting character in Battle Creek, and she was born in 1919. She was married at the age of 14. She lived outside of Battle Creek on a farm in Assyria Township in Michigan. She was married in 19, had an abusive husband, ended up divorced with one child. And her parents helped raise that child, and she went to work full-time along with her sister in Battle Creek, working in the cereal industry, which is kind of the heart and soul of Battle Creek.
Working for Kellogg's was like someone in Detroit working for Ford, Chrysler, or GM, wasn't it?
Yeah, and she ended up working at Kellogg's, which Kellogg's is kind of interesting. Like any major corporation, it has mm-hmm. its own little culture within itself, its own society within itself, and Daisy fit right into this. She was very well liked, very personable. She worked on a job that was on a production line that was very much out in public. So anyone walking through knew Daisy within the factory, small community. Daisy did have several affairs in her tenure there at Kellogg's. You know, there's been a lot of rumors over the years that mm-hmm. Daisy had a lot of affairs. I was only able to really track down about three of them. Well, as one officer put to me, though, when someone dies, everyone becomes a saint, you know. But Daisy was well-liked and well-respected, but someone apparently had a very sincere grudge against her.
So take us through her last day.
Oh, I'd love to. It was January 14th, 1963. Mm-hmm. They always tell you as an author, never open with the weather, but I have to. It was cold. It was below zero, snowing. There had been snow days before. As well, Daisy worked the afternoon shift. Her husband left for work. She was going to go meet with a friend for lunch and then go work the afternoon shift at Kellogg's. Never showed up.
Okay.
And her husband went to look for her, found her car abandoned about a mile and a half from their house on East Michigan Avenue, which is one of the most heavily traveled thoroughfares in Calhoun County. Went home and found her dead. She had been – the phone line had been cut in their house. She had had a struggle in both the kitchen and in their bedroom. Apparently, someone had tied her hands behind her back and had begun stabbing her in the bedroom, and Daisy fought back.
Wow. Even with her hands tied.
Even with her hands tied, she had made her way to the back bedroom where someone had continued to stab her. She had slid down the wall, and then whoever this was had known her well enough, they straddled her body and continued to stab her. Inflicting over 27 stab wounds and a bludgeon wound behind her ear. broke her ribs and used what was what we would call a utility knife, but at Kellogg's they were called spoilage knives. They were used to kind of cut open cardboard boxes, etc. That's believed to be the murder weapon.
Did they find a murder weapon, or was that deduced from the wounds?
Well, they found it in her sink. Daisy had a spoilage knife that she used to cut chicken with. Mm-hmm. They found traces of blood on it. They're not sure whether it was human blood or chicken blood. There wasn't a large enough sample for them to verify. But whoever it was did not drive to Daisy's house. Whoever it was, there was no car seen there, but the person had been seen from some distance away at her door. So whoever went there very deliberately on the coldest day of the year.
Mm. Walking.
Walking or had been dropped off. And they abandoned her car on a major thoroughfare.
Mm-hmm.
And either they had a car waiting for them or someone picked them up.
This gruesome murder is the subject of the book Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick. And don't worry, this wasn't recent. This happened 50 years ago, January 14th, 1963. And writer Blaine Pardo has put this all together. And amazing to think that in these five decades, no one's been brought to justice. Yet, as you point out in your book, Blaine, people saw the killer, correct?
Well, absolutely. Fred Ritchie of the Calhoun County Sheriff's Department was running late, taking a prisoner to court, and drove by the person walking in front of Daisy Zick's car. He didn't know there had been a murder at that point. And he made a mental note, if I come back and see this person walk along the road, I'll give him a ride. 1963, you picked up hitchhikers.
You did.
She was seen. The killer was as well seen by the neighbor, Mrs. DeFrance, who looked over and at about 50 yards, 80 yards distance, saw the killer at her, Daisy's door, but no vehicle. And later, two more witnesses came forward. One came forward 2 months later with a very accurate description of the killer. He had been following Daisy's car as it was abandoned and was so angry at the person for driving slow, he kind of looked over to glare at the person and made eye contact with the killer. Another person came forward 4 years later and said, I had also seen that person, but unfortunately so much time had passed and so much of the emphasis of the investigation had been on Kellogg's itself and that small, tight-knit community.
And that must have, in turn, because so many people in Battle Creek worked there, that must have really hit the community hard.
It really did. Daisy had a reputation, whether it was rightfully earned or not. I try not to go there, because that we don't know the details of all that. But you have to bear in mind what the police looked at was a very vague description of a man at the door. So the first place they looked was where Daisy worked. So if you skipped work that day, this was a horrible day to skip work. Picture, if you will, the police showing up at your door and saying, we want to talk to you about the murder of Daisy Zick. You'd actually just maybe skipped out to have drinks with your friends. And can you imagine how much marital strife that caused if your wife is sitting there and she's heard reputations of Daisy's, illicit dealings? So there was a lot of tension. They interviewed and polygraphed 87 people at the Kellogg's Corporation, fingerprinted, polygraphed, and interviewed them on this. So the implications were widespread. There were four poor boys who skipped school that day from Harper Creek High School. Can you imagine what a terrible day to skip school? The police show up at your house and they want to know where you were and what you saw.
So even with all of these people taking polygraph tests, even with witnesses actually looking at the killer, and there was never a lineup or there was never anybody who was a real good suspect?
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
There were some good suspects. My book is really the first time we've been able to reveal those because I used a Freedom of Information Act to really pry open the files and put it out there for the first time. There were several suspects over the years, but the primary one seemed to be the postman, William Daly. Mr. Daly was he gave a story the day of the crime that did not match some of the facts. He changed that story when they brought him back in 2 years later. He had a very distinctive hairstyle, parted down the middle and feathered back.
Mm-hmm.
1963, the hairstyles were crew cut and a Princeton, and that was it.
That hairstyle would have fit in the 80s or the 70s, but yeah, that's interesting.
And he had the same style as the description of both of the men who had the eyewitness account of them. He threatened his daughter-in-law with bodily violence and said during that attack, "I know who killed Daisy Zick," which seems to be a very strange context. But the thing that struck my wife probably the most was he had been interviewed the day of this brutal crime. It was on TV. His wife had worked with Daisy at Kellogg's at one point. He didn't tell his wife even that he had been interviewed by the police.
So that's odd.
There's a lot of things that come up inconsistent. Now, the police finally zeroed in on him in 1967. They said, wait a minute, there was an officer, Leroy Steinbacher, who really crawled through this case and kind of breathed new life into it. He realized the inconsistencies, spotted those things. They brought in William Daly. His story didn't match up again. And they said, let's bring you back for a polygraph. He said, I'm going down to Florida for 2 weeks. And then when I'm back, I'll be happy to be polygraphed. He left and never came back.
They let him go.
Well, they didn't have an inconsistent story on a 3-year-old case at that point. It just wasn't enough to be able to have probable cause to hold him. And William Daly is the only person in the volumes of this file that was ever had the name suspect attached to it. And to let you know, the police, this became a generational thing. It was passed on from generation to generation of law enforcement officers. In 2001, they again went through the case file and they said they had heard a rumor that Mr. Daly was dying and in the hospital in Florida. They sent down a team of officers, including a polygrapher, realizing most of the witnesses are dead.
Right.
You could never bring these folks into court anyway at that point. They're in their 70s and 80s, and their testimony would be bad. They got down, said, all we want to do is get closure for the Zick family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell us, give us a polygraph, tell us what you know, and he refused.
He refused.
Turns out he wasn't dying at the time, but he did pass away just this last year.
When you think about, apart from people being called in and hauled in for a polygraph test, what that murder must have meant to the peace of mind to people in Battle Creek, can't even estimate it.
I have been shocked. Everywhere when I tell people I'm working on a book on the history of Battle Creek, if I'm vague about it, they always come up with two or three names and Daisy Zicks is at the top. And that, I don't go looking for books. They kind of look for me. And this is something that really stuck in Battle Creek's mind because there was such a level of brutality in this crime, and it seemed so random. And she was such a well-known and well-liked person, despite any of her lifestyle choices and things along those lines, that the fear was, wow, the killer could be my neighbor. It could be my coworker. And whoever it was never brought to justice.
Now, you've put a call out in your book. You kind of challenged the reading public. If anybody knows anything, here's your time. Have you heard from anyone? Have you gotten any leads?
Well, anything I get, I pass directly on to the police. I'm an author and a historian. My job's to tell stories. I'm not an investigator, but it's amazing. People will tell me things and never pick up the phone to tell the police. I have had numerous people reach out to me with, frankly, in some cases, some of the craziest theories. But, you know, the ones that are tangible, that have a chance of fitting the evidence, et cetera, I've passed those on to the police and they've taken a look at them. And I've had a few myself where I've gone through and said, wow, this person, you never looked at this person's fingerprints. What if this situation happened? And that was the case with the Cooley family. Albert Cooley had been brought in and interviewed about his potential relationship with Daisy Zick. He went and they said, let's arrange a polygraph. He agreed and went home that night and killed himself.
That's right.
Sure looks suspicious, you know. And they checked his fingerprints, but his brother several months later tried to kill himself. And I told the officers, well, maybe the brother was the one that was involved and Albert was worried about implicating him. So have you ever checked this set of fingerprints? And so things like that are where I've passed on information, and I've had a number of theories I've had to pass on to the police.
So from the perspective of 50 years out and look, almost 51 years now, looking back, what's your gut feeling as to why she was killed and the way she was killed?
Well, the way she was killed, I think, was bizarre on many – the crime scene doesn't tell you an accurate story. It doesn't tell you a consistent story. Some of her wounds indicate somebody was left-handed. Some indicate someone who was right-handed. Hard to tell. You know, the witness descriptions, I'm fairly certain, pointed to a man. If it was William Daly, chances are he was stalking her. He had admitted to several people he had seen Daisy Zick sunbathing nude. Now, I checked with some of the young boys who lived in that neighborhood and was told, yeah, it was a well-known thing. We would peek through the hedges and see Mrs. Zick in her backyard. Well, this is a rural postal carrier. He delivered from his car. The Zick house is set back a good 80 or 90 feet. I've been by it.
That would take some doing, wouldn't it?
There's hedges that surrounded it. How would he have seen Daisy sunbathing nude in the backyard? There's no way I could see where you could get that angle. And, you know, when you start looking at it, you start going for what may have been more simple. While people were looking for someone who was having an affair with Daisy, it may be that it was just a simple case of someone who was being stalked and was told no and couldn't deal with that rejection or something along those lines. You know, as well, there have been theories floated over the years that it could be a woman. In 1963, the concept of a woman doing such a savage and brutal crime didn't fit the public psyche, and it wasn't something the police were able to really wrap their hands around.
But sure.
In the 1990s, Gary Hoag, an investigator for the state police, said, well, what if it was a female that
somebody
we saw?
Unhappy with perhaps something going on with her husband. Who knows? What about Daisy's son?
Jim King is still very much alive with us, and I'm thankful for that. And when I worked on this, whenever you do these, it's always a sensitive moment as an author when you reach out to either the victim's family or, and if it's a case that's closed, the murderer's family. And you never know what reaction you're going to get. Jim King was incredibly supportive. He really filled in the gaps to tell the story of Daisy's life, which I included in the book. But more importantly, I met him when I was doing a book signing for my other book, Secret Witness. He came by to drop off some pictures and so we could meet face to face. And I talked to him on the phone and emailed, and I saw him, and when he talked about his mother, I can't describe it any other way, but I saw a 13 or 14-year-old boy talking about his mother. The years disappeared. You know, the love that he had for his mother and the love I think that the whole family had for Daisy is still there. And to me, I said at that point, no matter what, this book's got to go out. We've got to find who did this. If nothing, it'll never go to trial. Even though all the evidence is still in the state police vaults, it's probably never going to trial, but they can close the case if they can get someone to come forward and say, I gave somebody a lift that day. Maybe it was a postman walking down the road and said, I got to drop off a package and my car broke down. Or, gee, I gave a lift to somebody, you know, over by where the car was abandoned. Never dawned on me that they might be related to this crime. Someone else saw the killer. We had four or five people that saw that person that day. Somebody else had to have.
The book is Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick, and we've been speaking with the author, Blaine Pardo. Thanks for talking with us and coming in today.
Well, thanks for having me.